Welcome to Talking Dollars and Cents on TalkZone.com, the show dedicated to all facets of your financial life. Now, here's your host, Bruce McMenemy.
Hey, this is Bruce McMenemy here on Talking Dollars and Cents.com. This is the inaugural show. This show is dedicated basically to answering questions and issues that you may have. Hopefully it'll keep you entertained and informed, and bounce along. You can send your questions by email to bruce@talkingdollarsandcents.com. That's dollars and cents, S-E-N-S-E. When you send your email, give your first name and a city. No last names, phone numbers, or any of that type of thing, obviously. Let me tell you a little bit about myself, and then we'll go right into some of the questions. My background is I'm a licensed certified public accountant in multiple states. I'm a certified fraud examiner. I'm a forensic certified public accountant. But more than that, I most of my experience has come from being a college professor. I was a college professor, tenured for about 13, 14 years in New York. And I've continued to teach as an adjunct professor in the areas of tax law and forensics. Forensics and accounting has become a very big topic, especially in the areas of divorce and litigation. Now, in general, your questions I'm going to answer will be general answers, because this way they'll apply to a whole range of people. You should always, and I stress always, speak to your own legal or tax advisor on anything to do with your own particular circumstances. One thing I've learned in 30 years of practice is every single detail makes a difference. Change a fact a little bit in a particular issue and you change the entire answer. So keep that in mind. I'm dealing with a snippet of information and I can give you my best opinion based on that, but you always need to go back to your legal or tax advisor in your particular circumstances and make sure that you have it, you have all the details and you have it right. If I don't know the answer to something, I'll flat out tell you, and I'll tell you where to go. At least so you can maybe possibly get some help. Well, let's get going. We'll start with our first question. Remember, all money issues are fair game. So if you have any types of questions on insurance, taxes, the stock market, I won't give you stock market advice on particular stocks, but I will give you some ideas as to where I think the market's going and what some of the experts are saying. If you've got legal questions, obviously I'm not an attorney, but I can give you some guidance in that area, at least give you some ideas or some direction. Okay, let's go to our first email. It's from Vince, and so you know, on some of these emails, they tend to be a bit wordy, and I'll try and snip them down a little bit and streamline them. First email is from Vince in Miami, and Vince's question is, I own a lawn business and pay my help in cash. I got into an argument with one of them, and I fired him. I just got a letter that he has filed for unemployment. My father-in-law says he can't collect. Is this a big problem? Well, it kind of depends, Vince. Big problem for you or a big problem for him? I think it's a problem for him. It's a much bigger problem potentially for you. For him, he's not going to be able to collect unemployment because you never paid unemployment on his employment. So he's never been reported, so he's not going to be able to collect. From your standpoint, the problem you've got is they're going to ask you why you never paid on them and why you never collected the taxes and why you never paid and why you're paying them in cash. That can be a real problem from a IRS standpoint, from a state tax authority standpoint. Paying people in cash, I know, was very, very common, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. Today, it's become less common. It still goes on, obviously. You know, people refer to that as the underground economy, and it's nowhere near as big as it used to be for a whole host of reasons. One, it potentially is a criminal problem. Depending on the number of workers you're paying in cash and how much is involved, you could have a bad situation there. My suggestion would be you need to go probably speak to a CPA or potentially an attorney, and probably file your back taxes. Basically, fess up. That's your best bet. Fess up, pay the penalties, make the situation right, and go from there. Don't, and I stress this, don't try and cover it up, because it's very simple. What they're going to do is they're going to speak to your former worker, and he's going to tell them other people that have worked for you, and they're going to try and contact them, and a problem will grow, and it's not a place you want to be. So I would definitely go speak to somebody about it, and don't just sweep it under the rug, because it is a problem. And I wish I had a better answer for you, but there really is none. It is a problem. This comes up quite a bit, not so much in unemployment taxes. Where it'll come up very, very frequently is in the case of workers' comp. You know, you'll have an employee that works for you, and he might even be like a subcontractor. You know, let's say, for example, you're running a painting business, and you get a couple of guys to work for you, and you're treating them as subcontractors. You're paying them by the job, and they'll show up at a house and they'll start doing some painting, and they'll get up on a ladder and they'll fall. Well, you can very easily get yourself into a workers' comp situation where that particular person wants to try and collect for their injury, and potentially you maybe should have had workers' compensation insurance on them. And that can become a criminal problem. That can also be a problem for the homeowner themselves. You know, I'm a homeowner. I call you up, or I see an ad to have my house painted. In all good faith, I hire you to come in and do the painting. And meantime, you don't have all your I's and T's dotted and crossed. And a worker falls, and he ends up suing me, the homeowner. Now, my homeowner's insurance likely will cover me, but potentially not, and they could end up in a bad situation. So it's something to watch. If you're a homeowner and you hire a contractor to come in and do work for you, whether it's, you know, painting, carpentry, pool services, you should always ask them if they've got workers' comp insurance, and you can ask them for a certificate. It's not unusual to supply certificates that basically will then cover the homeowner. Okay, Matt, in Atlanta. Okay, Matt leased a car, and it's due back in 3 months, so it's coming off lease. Matt says, I'm way over the mileage. I think I owe them about $3,000 for the extra mileage. How much do they go after people? Okay, I guess what he means by that is, how much trouble am I in? Well, when you lease a car, basically you lease it under the terms of the leasing agreement. And in most cases, as you probably, as you know, if you lease cars, you usually get a mileage allowance, which is very commonly is 10,000 miles a year or 12,000 miles a year. Foreign cars, it tends to be less. American cars, it tends to be more. But in any case, you basically agree to return the car in A, good condition, B, subject to the amount of mileage they've allowed you, and three, you return it on time. Well, returning on time is not usually a problem. Mileage usually becomes a big problem because people tend to underestimate the amount of mileage that they drive, and they want to get the cheapest payment when they lease the car. So they'll take a lease payment that's low, figuring, well, I'm not going to drive the car that much, and after a while, that idea goes away, and before they know it, they're running up against the mileage limits. In most cases on a lease, the additional mileage is on a per mileage basis, which is usually 25 cents, could be 30 cents. I've seen as high as 50 cents on some luxury cars per mile. So if you've got an extra 10,000 miles on the car, you know, you're supposed to only put 36,000 miles on it and you put 46. They're going to say, you owe us 10,000 miles times 25 cents is an extra $2,500 at the end of the lease. Do they go after people for that? They absolutely do. They'll immediately send you a bill. If you don't pay it, they'll put you into collections. And if you don't pay through collections, there's a chance they could file a small claim suit against you, depending on the amount of money involved. They will definitely ding your credit. If you turn a car in and you've got overage charges and you don't pay them, pretty likely you're not going to be able to lease the car again. It's going to show up on your credit. A really big area to watch when you lease a car, and this happens all the time, is damage. what you consider damage and what the leasing company considers damage when you turn the car in are two entirely different things. In most cases, and every leasing company is different, each manufacturer is different. They all have their own standards, and it's something you really should ask before you lease the car. What, you know, get a list of what their standards are in terms of damage. Some companies use a dime as a reference. Some use a nickel. Some use a quarter. And what that means is when you go to turn the car in at the end of the lease, they're going to have an inspector go over the car, and every ding, mark, scratch, whatever, that exceeds that benchmark, let's say it's a nickel, they're going to take a nickel, they're going to put it up against that mark. If it exceeds that nickel size, they're going to charge you for it. And if you've got a number of those, you could end up with a complete new paint job on that car, which can be extremely expensive. Another area where I've seen people run into huge problems with leasing and end of lease is smoking in the car. Now, I don't like to say this, but I'm a smoker myself. Smoking in a leased car today is a really bad idea, because what will happen is when you go to turn the car in, they'll say that the entire interior has got to be shampooed and cleaned, which can be anywhere from $400 to $800. I've seen in some situations where they don't even go that route. They basically tell you the interior has to be replaced, which means the seats pretty much and the rugs. That gets expensive. That could run $1,500 to $2,000 depending on the type of car and the value. Now, obviously less for a Ford Mustang, quite a bit more for a Mercedes. So it really kind of depends. When you lease a car, you're taking a lot of responsibility, and sometimes it's not necessarily as cheap as you think it might be. There are hidden costs. All right, Matt, I hope that answered your question. They'll end up going after you, so you need to deal with it. Something you might want to consider is if the damages are too high and the turning costs are too high, you might consider just buying the car out from the lease, if you have that option. You may find by doing that, you can sell the car in the private market, resale, and not have as many problems and potentially not as much cost. Or you might just consider buying the car and using it for another year or two, and hopefully the value won't decline as much, and therefore you can get yourself right side up. Okay, next, we have an email from Greg in Stewart. I guess that's Florida. I just got my homeowner's insurance bill, and it has gone up to $2,700. Ouch. I imagine that's per year. I can't afford to pay it. What happens with my bank, and what do I do? Okay, since, Greg, you're saying that you have a bank, I assume you have a mortgage. Now, usually in a mortgage situation, there's two ways that banks handle insurance, homeowners insurance. Most people pay their homeowners insurance through what's known as an escrow account. The bank estimates the amount of insurance each year, and then at some point, they adjust it. So, for example, if your insurance is estimated to be $1,200 a year, they'll take $100 a year, put it onto your mortgage payment, and it goes into escrow. And then they pay the bill when it comes due. That's the most common thing. In this particular case, I assume that you're probably not in an escrow arrangement, which means you pay it, and then you have to send the bank a copy of the homeowner's insurance after you paid it. What happens in that situation is if you don't pay the homeowner's insurance, the bank likely will try and pay it directly. Many cases, they're not able to do that on a timely basis. So what they do, and this is part of your mortgage documents in most cases, is they have the ability to go out in the secondary market and get insurance to cover themselves. That is not a good thing, because they're not obligated to go get the cheapest kind of insurance. They just need to get insurance. So that $2,700 homeowner's insurance bill could very easily go to $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 that you're going to be obligated to pay the bank. Now, if you don't pay them, you're probably in violation of your mortgage agreement, and it could be a default. which has all kinds of legal ramifications, and potentially they could foreclose on you. If you're not going to pay the homeowner's insurance bill, I would definitely contact the bank and see what you can work out. They might be willing to reduce your payment for a month or two in order for you to do it, give you some kind of a deferred option. I wouldn't just ignore it because it is a problem. Depending on how that conversation goes with the bank, you might want to speak to an attorney as to what the best way to handle it is in your particular state, because defaults and foreclosures differ by state depending on state law. So I would definitely talk to an attorney and make sure that you got your I's and T's all dotted and crossed. Speaking of foreclosures, obviously foreclosures are a real hot topic the past couple of years. And short sales and buying property out of foreclosure, buying a house that was foreclosed upon. Very, very careful consideration has to be made when you get involved in buying houses that have been foreclosed on. You can end up with all kinds of problems that are unforeseen. So if you're going to get in that situation, make sure you speak to a good real estate attorney and make sure that in your area you know what you're doing. Okay, let's take a break here. We'll be back in about 90 seconds.
Welcome back to Talking Dollars and Cents on Talk Zone. Here's Bruce McMenemy.
Okay, we're back. Once again, you can reach us at 888-GO-FOR-IT. That's 888-463-6748. Or you can email your question to bruce@talkingdollarsandcents.com. Please just give your first name and city. And try and be as concise as you can, because sometimes people get wordy in emails, so I need to cut through them. All right, let's go to another question here from Brandy. She didn't list a city. I want to go to school and get a job as a medical assistant. I live with my mom, and she can't afford to pay for it. Can I get a loan? Well, Brandy, yeah, you probably can, depending on the type of program. Medical assisting, usually if it's a regulated and qualified program, will qualify for usually private types of loans through like Sallie Mae. They're not cheap. What you might want to consider, which I've seen a number of people do, is many counties, depending on where you live, but you probably live in a county because everybody does, have grants that are available usually from the state. I know, for example, in the state of Florida, they have grants that the state gives out, which will pay entirely, completely for the program. I've seen situations where people have gone for like medical assistant or dental assistant, or even sometimes auto mechanic, refrigerator, an HVAC repair. And some of these programs can cost $5,000, $6,000, $7,000. And depending on your income status and your mom's, if you're a dependent, they can pay completely for the entire program without you taking a loan. So that's definitely something for you to check out. In almost all cases, you can get some kind of assistance. I applaud you for wanting to go to school. Obviously, in today's job market, you need every advantage you possibly can, and going to school is definitely very much in your favor. Good luck with that, and like I said, check out the state and county programs. You can call the county, and they usually have some kind of a coordinator for community assistance, and they should be able to guide you. Okay, next we go to an email from Maddie in New York. No city, but state of New York. Should I collect Social Security at age 62, or should I wait till I'm age 65? All right, that's a good question. That's something people wrestle with every day. And the answer to it is it depends. Are you healthy? If you're healthy and you like your job, keep working. That's the bottom line. If you like your job and you're healthy, keep working as long as you possibly can. For you, some of you younger people out there that maybe haven't thought about Social Security because it's not on your radar screen at this point. Most people today, depending on their age, usually if they're age 58 and over, 59 and over, will be able to collect Social Security at age 65. As you move beyond that age, the eligibility age for Social Security starts to increase. So, for example, if you're age 57 today, you'll start collecting Social Security when you're roughly age 66, and that'll tend to move up as you move on in time. The difference between collecting at age 62 and age 65 is fairly substantial. To give you a rough idea, it's about a third. So, for example, at age 62, you might collect $1,200 a month, depending on your past work experience. At age 65, you might collect $1,600 a month. So by waiting that extra 3 years, you're going to increase the amount of monthly income you're going to receive from Social Security. The question is it worth it? And that goes back to the fact pattern in your particular case. If you're healthy and you like your job, keep working. If you're not, you may want to consider taking it early. So, for example, say you're collecting $1,200 at age 62 and $1,600 at age 65. That's a $400 difference per month. But you have to look at the other side of that. If you start collecting at age 62, you're going to receive $1,200 a month for 36 months from 62 to age 65 that you wouldn't have collected. So $1,200 a month for 36 months is about $43,000. So you'll have collected $43,000 when you reach age 65. At 65, you're going to collect $400 a month less. So the question is, how long does it take to get even or balance that out? Or at $400 a month, how long does that $43,000 go? And it's about 8 years or so. So 8 years from age 65, you'd be age 73. So at age 73, at that point going forward, you would be ahead if you waited to 65. If, God forbid, you were to die before that age of 73, you'd be behind the eight ball. Not that you care, but that's how it would work out financially. So this, I mean, there's no right or wrong answer to this. It basically depends on how healthy you are, whether you've got other support, whether you can afford to leave your job. I usually tell people, make sure you look at your family history. You know, if you've got a family history where you've got your mom and your dad live to age 90, well, chances are you very well might live to age 90, and you might want to wait as long as you possibly can because you're going to need that money. If your situation is you have bad genes and people tend to die young, you know, say at age 65, well, then you might want to consider to smell in the roses and start collecting at age 62. It just kind of depends on you. Okay, hopefully that helps, Maddie. Definitely sit down with a financial planner and look at the assets you have. You also got to look at health care. You can't start collecting Medicare until you're age 65. So if you leave your job at age 62, you're going to have to make sure you have some kind of medical coverage between age 62 and 65. So you really want to sit down with someone that knows what you're doing in that area. Certified financial planner, a good CPA, somebody that kind of has a handle on those requirements. Okay, let's go to DJ in Denver. I own a rental house with my brother. We don't need to get into that. I am sick of dealing with the issues. It is worth $160,000, and we owe about $150,000 on the house. He has given me $10,000 to get out, and I will give him a quick claim deed. Is that a good deal? All right. First of all, DJ, it's not a quick claim deed. A lot of people make that mistake. It's a quit, Q-U-I-T, claim deed. And basically what a quit claim deed is, it's a very quick way of transferring whatever interest you may have in a piece of property. And the interest you transfer is only as good as the interest you have. Every state's different. Some states have what's called warranty deeds, where when you convey the property, you're basically agreeing that you have certain rights and you'll enforce those rights. in a quit claim deed, you're just transferring whatever interest you may have. Is it a good deal? Well, it depends. I mean, if you're really rental property is an area that I see all the time where people say, oh, gee whiz, if I can buy this house and rent it out, I could sit back and be comfortable, and people are paying off the mortgage, and I'll make a couple bucks, and 20 years from now, I'll own the house free and clear, and I'll sell it. What a great way to make money and move on with my life. And there's all these infomercials, I should say, that tout all these real estate systems and how you can make a gazillion dollars buying and selling property and flipping them. And I'll be honest with you. Yeah, people do make money flipping houses, and yeah, people do make money renting houses. For every person that does that, there's five that have horror stories. So be very, very careful if you're going to get involved in renting houses. Lack of tenants, having the house vacant, securing the house, having a tenant that's not paying is probably your worst situation, where you just think, well, if he's not paying, I'll just have to throw him out. Well, a lot of times that's not as simple as you might think, especially you can get into all kinds of different ramifications where you have a tenant that maybe has children. It's just not that simple. You can't just walk in and say, yeah, not paying me, get out. You have to follow the legal process, and sometimes that's very frustrating. There's nothing worse than having someone as a tenant who's not paying you, especially if they're not taking care of the home. It's difficult to have access as a practical matter. So when DJ says he's got issues and he's sick of dealing with them, I can certainly understand that. All right, now, he's going to get $10,000 to get out. Right now, there's only $10,000 worth of equity in the property. So on the face of it, he's entitled to $5,000, and his brother's entitled to $5,000. So he's getting a bonus of $5,000 pretty much to get out. That sounds good, but you got to really consider a couple things here. You say you owe $150,000, so that implies that there's a mortgage on this property. And I would assume that when you took the mortgage, both of you, you and your brother, both signed the mortgage, which means you're both on the hook. The fact that you give him a quit claim deed and get off the deed does not free you from your mortgage obligation. So in short, you still are responsible for making sure that mortgage gets paid. So you go down 3, 4, 5 years and your brother decides he's sick of it and he can't do anything with the property and he can't sell it. So he just collects the rent money from the tenant and doesn't pay the mortgage. Guess what? You're going to have a problem. So you need to make sure that if you're going to get out of this property, you have to get the mortgage paid off, which means your brother's going to have to refinance the property. That's the only way. That's really the only way of doing it. He can't give you anything that says he'll be responsible and you're not, because the mortgage company right now has something saying that you're obligated to them. So, and this comes up a lot. Not only just in the case of rental houses, it'll come up quite a bit when you've got a divorce situation, which we can get back to at some other point. But, you know, a husband leaves or a wife leaves and turns the house over to the other spouse and completely forgets that they're obligated on the mortgage. As divorces sometimes go, people get mad at each other down the road, and to get even, one spouse may just decide to stop paying the mortgage, and it'll end up screwing up the other spouse in terms of credit and everything else. So be very, very careful in these situations. All right, let's take about a 90-second break, and we'll be back.
And now, more Talking Dollars and Cents on TalkZone.com. Here's Bruce McMenemy.
Okay, we're back. Let's see. I have an email here from No Name in Orlando. My attorney said if I do a short sale, I will owe a bunch of taxes. He thinks I should file for bankruptcy. Does that sound cool? Okay, in regard to it, what's a short sale? A short sale is when, for example, you have a house and let's say you owe the bank $200,000 on it and you can't get a buyer for the house for any more than $150,000. Well, obviously, you can't sell the house for $150,000 if you owe $200,000 because the person buying it's going to owe the balance of the mortgage and they're not going to do that. So you have to basically go to your mortgage company and ask them to accept $150,000 to satisfy the mortgage. And that's called a short sale because you're selling your selling price is short of the amount owed. Okay, I will owe a bunch of taxes. What the attorney's talking about there is if the bank decides to satisfy your mortgage for less money than is actually owed, that's what's referred to under tax law as a cancellation of debt. And believe it or not, that's income. It's no different than if somebody paid you for working $50,000 for the year. You've received the benefit of $50,000, and that's income, and you got to pay tax on it. And a lot of people just they never even think about this because usually when you do a short sale, you're in a bad spot financially, and the last thing you're thinking about, unfortunately, is the tax consequence. This area gets complicated, and you've got to really look at your own particular fact pattern as to what potentially you could be liable for. In most cases, and I stress most, but not all, there are what's called safe harbor provisions under the tax law. And if you own this home and it's your homestead, you're not renting it, it's not business property, there are provisions up to certain dollars amounts that will allow you to cancel the amount of taxes maybe due. And there's paperwork that gets filed with your tax returns that does that. And there are dollar limits on it. And you really need to speak to somebody about your particular circumstances. The one thing I can stress, and this happens all the time, the cancellation of debt safe harbor does not apply to rental property. So if you've got a house that you've been using for business property, I mean you're renting it out, and you end up in a situation where you got to get rid of it and you do a short sale, you very definitely or very likely to end up in a situation where you're going to owe income taxes on the amount that the bank decided to forego in order to accomplish the short sale. Now, bankruptcy. He thinks I should file for bankruptcy. Well, that kind of depends. It depends on what your other financial circumstances are. If it's just the short sale, I don't know. But it would depend on what your other situation is in terms of how much you owe. You got a lot of credit card debt, that type of thing. Your attorney really would be in the best position to understand your entire situation. So I wouldn't dismiss it. I would probably go back and ask him, when you say, oh, a bunch of taxes, maybe discuss your particular details and see if he has a better handle. If he doesn't know tax law, you might want to speak to either another attorney or a CPA that might be able to give you some advice on that. Filing for bankruptcy today, it doesn't have the stigma that it used to. I can remember back, 25, 30 years ago, if somebody said, oh, I filed for bankruptcy, there was this really negative connotation that, they were a dirtbag is a little bit strong, but you would say, oh, gee whiz, the guy doesn't know how to handle his money, and gee whiz, I don't know if he's trustworthy. Today, that's not the case. Bankruptcy today and foreclosures and that type of thing and debt judgments just don't have the same negative connotation that they used to. So I wouldn't say don't do bankruptcy because of the negative connotation. But you don't want to do a bankruptcy on a frivolous basis. You want to make sure it's absolutely something that's necessary. The other thing a lot of people don't realize is the bankruptcy law has changed quite a bit in the past few years. It used to be able to walk in and basically just walk away from all your debts scot-free. And that was it. Well, today it doesn't quite work like that. You may still be responsible for some of your debts going forward. So it's not quite as easy to file for bankruptcy as it used to be. So take a look at that. Like I said, speak to your attorney, speak to a CPA, and get a better handle on all the details. Okay, we got an email from Jim in Dallas. Do those extended warranties pay to buy? Okay, I think what Jim's probably talking about is, you know, you walk into, for argument's sake, Best Buy or Target, and you buy an item, and they say, oh, for $4.95, we can give you an extended warranty that'll cover you for breakage and that type of thing. In most cases, in my opinion, and this is a personal opinion, there's no right or wrong answer to these things. No, absolutely not. They don't pay. I mean, you walk in and, you know, you buy an item for $55 and they give you an extended warranty for $5.95. Well, that's, you know, more than 10% of the purchase price. Doesn't pay. In most cases, if an item's going to break, it'll break right out of the box and you can usually return it. The other thing is, as a practical matter, you know, you end up buying something, it breaks 6 months down the road. You've either completely forgotten about the warranty or you've lost it. And even if you haven't, you've got to go through the trouble usually of mailing the item to the warranty company and with documentation and the amount of time and effort involved, ordinarily, it's just not worth it. So I would say absolutely, absolutely not. Another way of looking at this is extended warranties are huge, huge profit makers for the companies that sell them. And the reason is most people don't take advantage of them. They'll buy them initially. They'll completely forget about them or not be bothered. And for the extended warranty company, that's just flat out free money. It's kind of like, coupons and rebates. Do you ever wonder why? I mean, years ago, you got a coupon. You went to the store. You turned the coupon in. They took the money off the purchase price. You walked out. You were done. And then they started to get into these rebates. And the rebate required you to take your cash register receipt and fill out a form and, you know, put all kinds of documentation together and mail it in. And then they would turn around and send you a check in, you know, 3 or 4 months. Why did they start doing that? Well, the simple reason is the rebate was the inducement for you to buy the item. Now you go buy an item and then you got a $10 rebate. You say, oh, okay, the price is actually $40, not $50, because I get a $10 rebate. And then what happens is you don't follow through. Very common. I don't know what the latest statistics are on redemption rates for rebates, but they're fairly low. You know, you get into a $1,000 item, yeah, it's going to be fairly high because you maybe get a large rebate and you might follow through. But on smaller items, the $5 and the $10 rebates, they just don't get done. So the company's got the advantage of inducing you to buy the product, thinking that you're paying less, but then has the benefit of you not following through and actually collecting. So those extended warranties, don't do it. What you might want to consider is using Amex, American Express. They are wonderful when it comes to extending warranties automatically, and they're absolutely great when it comes to things like iPads, which – We can talk about in a couple of minutes. I'll give you some ideas of situation I have with an iPad that American Express was just wonderful about in terms of replacing. Okay, I think it's time here for us to take another short break, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
You're listening to Talking Dollars and Cents on TalkZone.com. Back to Bruce McMenemy.
Okay, before the break, I was mentioning Amex, which is American Express. I've used American Express for years, and because of their extended warranty policy, and very, very rarely have ever had to use it, but in two instances in the past 2 years, I've had to use it, and I can't tout them enough. They were just great. We had bought my daughter an iPhone, and as some of you probably had this experience, she had it all of about 3 days, and it was stolen from her locker at school. And we called American Express, and they basically said, well, did you file a police report? And we said, yep, we did. And they said, well, could you send us a copy of it? And I said, absolutely. And they said, okay, well, send us a copy of it, and the minute you send it to us, and you could do it by email, which we did, while we were on the line with them on the phone, in about 3 minutes, they said, okay, we've just credited your account for the amount of the iPhone, so go buy a new one. And I just walked away stunned. It was just like, God, was that, I mean, no, I was expecting all kinds of hoops I had to jump through and, you know, all kinds of problems. And it was just great. Another situation, about 4 months ago, I bought a new iPad, an iPad 4. I should have waited another couple months. I got the 5, but, or the Air, but I didn't. And I had the thing, about a day. And I made the mistake of putting it in an old case that I had from an iPad 1. And it didn't fit properly, and I should have known better. And I went to move it. It slipped out of my hand and landed on the kitchen floor, which is tile, and just destroyed it. I mean, broke the screen, dented it. It was just gone. And, you know, obviously I was fairly upset. And my wife reminded me, she said, well, don't worry about it. You bought it on Amex. And I was like, oh, that's right. They covered damage. And I called them. Same deal. They said, take some pictures of it. Give us the serial number. Send it over, and we'll give you credit for the iPad, and you'll buy a new one, which is what I did. I'm not a spokesman for Amex, or they're not an advertiser, but they're just wonderful. It's just something to keep in mind. So often we have problems with companies, and we're really quick to put them down. But when you get treated right, it's probably incumbent on us to make sure we pat them on the back when we can. Okay, let's go to our next question. Let's see, email from Lewis in Ocean City, Maryland. By the way, if you want to send in any questions after the show ends, you're welcome to do that. Send them to Bruce at talkingdollarsandcents.com, and we'll put them on a show next week or on a future show. So keep your questions coming. All right, Lewis in Ocean City, Maryland says, the dry cleaner I go to lost 2 suits. He is claiming that his insurance company will only cover $100 per suit because they were used. If I take the money, I have to sign a release. It costs more than $200 to take him to small claims court. Should I take the money? Well, good question. The dry cleaner is probably being truthful in that he's probably has an insurance policy that basically covers him for lost or damaged goods for his customers. What he's not telling you is that he can make up the difference. Because his insurance company is only obligated to pay a certain amount doesn't mean he can't make up the difference. This is a common situation in insurance, whether it's homeowners insurance or something like this. Insurance companies ordinarily won't pay you to buy a new item. They'll pay you what your item was worth. So obviously, if you've got a suit and you've worn it any number of times and you originally paid a couple hundred dollars for the suit, it's not worth a couple hundred dollars anymore. It's worth less. And that's referred to as a depreciated value. Now, what I would do, and in fact, I've done this in the past, I would take the money. First of all, I would explain to the dry cleaner your position that the suits were very expensive and $100 doesn't make you whole and you're a good customer and he should treat his customers or she should treat her customers better. And I would go that route. I would probably take the money and I would probably sign the release. The reason being, you really have nowhere else to go. I mean, if you go to small claims court, you know, and you're gonna sue for $200, $300, $400, it's just not worth the time or the effort, assuming that you win. I'd rather have the $200 definitely in my pocket and go from there. Now, does that mean you should just say, "Oh well, I'm gonna just have to eat the difference"? No. What you might consider doing, and like I said, I've done this. It's very effective, but you got to make sure you do it right. Is you pick it. What you do is you wait until the busiest time for that particular merchant is, and you stand outside with a sign that basically says, well, here's what happened. You know, customers going in there, here's what happened to me. It could happen to you. Very effective. Obviously, no merchant wants somebody standing outside with a sign that basically says, don't do business with this person. That being said, you got to be careful how you do this. First thing you got to make sure of is from a local standpoint, from, you know, from an ordinance standpoint, check with your county or city where the merchant's located and find out if there's any restrictions or time limits or where you can stand or what's considered a public area. Make sure you have that all down pat. So you're going to be in a place that you're allowed to be. So you don't have a trespassing situation. A lot of times shopping centers will prohibit this type of activity. And the question is whether they can or they can't. And you don't want to run afoul and end up with a lawsuit against you for, you know, maybe multiple dollars as opposed to the $200 you might be out of pocket. Make up a sign. The thing to be very careful about is to make sure that you only state the facts. Don't put on your sign that, you know, so-and-so dry cleaner is no good and you know, he's a cheat or anything like that. Just the facts. I brought in two suits. The dry cleaner lost them. He will not compensate me for the value entirely of the suits. What will happen is some people walking in will ask you what happened, and you can explain it. In short order, usually, not always, but usually, the merchant will say, oh, gee whiz, I can't have this person out there. And they'll wait and see if you'll do it, you know, if you've got the gumption to do it for more than about 10 or 15 minutes. And you hang out there for a half hour, 45 minutes, you're probably going to get some kind of relief. So that's a way to go. And again, obviously, it depends on your tolerance for being embarrassed by standing out there. Okay, Lewis, good luck with that. You might want to ask in the future when you go into a dry cleaner, ask them for their policy on lost or damaged goods. Can't hurt to be proactive and ask up front. Okay, let's see, this will probably be our last question here of the day. Got an email from Judy in the Bronx, New York. My son is going to start college next year. Student loans scare the heck out of me. Any thoughts? Student loans are a huge, huge problem today. College has gotten so expensive. I mean, inordinately expensive. To be honest with you, it's ridiculous at this point, the amount of tuition that people have to pay. And the problem is the students are ending up with huge amounts of student loan debt that when they graduate, even if they can find a job, they just don't generate enough dollars to be able to pay the student loans and live comfortably. It's a big issue. Going back to a question we had earlier about bankruptcy, people that have student loans and have investigated this will tell you, you can't go bankrupt on your student loans. There's a provision in the bankruptcy code that specifically exempts student loans from being discharged in bankruptcy. So once you got that student loan, you've got it. And the only way to get rid of it is to pay it. Now, a lot of times you can get deferments, you can default, and you know, you'll pay it down the road with, you know, interest and penalties, but you're going to end up paying it at some point. So you got to be very, very careful what student loans you take, and whether it's worthwhile. You know, to go to school to get a bachelor's degree today in English, I don't know. I mean, there's going to be a lot of English teachers out there. They're going to say, "Oh, it's wrong." Well, you've got, from a dollars and cents standpoint, that's what we're talking here, dollars and cents, getting an English degree today probably is not going to lead you to a high-paying job where you'll be able to pay back the student loans, if they're significant, from that employment. So you got to be smart. You might want to get an English degree and couple it with something else, maybe something in computers. Meld two majors together. That's really the way to go today. Attorneys. You find more and more attorneys now going into computer areas and going back and getting degrees in computer science, going into the areas of like e-discovery. CPAs, very, very much so are going back and getting degrees in computers and certifications in computers. Computer auditing are all hot topics. Computer forensics, forensic accounting. Today, you've got to differentiate yourself from the other guys out there. And especially if you're going to have, if you're going to have student loans, you're going to have the ability to pay them back. Anything in computers today is just the way to go. The only problem with computers is if you go into computers and you go into that field, you've got to be prepared to keep up. It changes so rapidly. You get out of school this year, 2 or 3 years from now, you could be behind the times. I mean, you've got to just stay up. I can remember we've got situations where you have COBOL programmers and even today Java programmers that were just the hottest commodity at the time and basically now become, you know, dime a dozen. So you've got to constantly make a commitment that you're going to stay with school, that you're going to go back, you're going to relearn, retrain, and go from there. All right, that's all the time we have for today. Once again, send in your questions to Bruce at talkingdollarsandcents.com. We'll get to them next week. And till then, be well, have a great week, and enjoy.